I'm currently in San Diego at our headquarters here in Kearny Mesa, over near Miramar Air Station. We're one of the few lucky defense tech companies that get to be in San Diego. I live on the East Coast, and I travel routinely, do a lot of the travel internationally as well. But this week, you find me in San Diego. So just a quick introduction about myself. Catherine did a great job of breaking down, you know, kind of my past in the military and what gives me a unique insight into, one, our go-to-market, but also product development and pipeline strategy. But a few years ago, four to be exact, myself and two other founders decided that we were going to start up a company to support some of the efforts in Ukraine, specifically around low-cost, affordable masks. Low-cost, affordable masks is easier said than done because it costs millions upon millions of dollars to build airframes. Lots of engineering time, lots of effort, and manufacturing is hard, and hardware is hard. But we set out to do this a few years ago, really with the thesis that we think we can build it for cheaper and most importantly, at the edge. And so what came out of a UAS company turned into the ability to manufacture UAS anywhere in the world. And so Firestorm right now is 150 people. We're VC-backed. We just closed out our first series of Series B, our first phase of Series B. And we're continuing to grow. We have people all over the world to include an international footprint, specifically focusing on INDOPACOM. But going back to kind of the thesis of our business is that we set out to build affordable UAS that was modular in nature so that it could basically capture the requirements and future requirements that the warfighters would have. Traditionally, when you buy a UAS platform or a weapon system, it takes you know, many years to get into production. And once it gets to the hands of the warfighter, you're not making significant changes to those products. And usually, that life cycle is determined in decades. And so our goal was that we were going to create systems that were future-proof, that could constantly evolve with warfighter integration, specifically in payloads. So think about new sensors, technology, a new camera comes out. How do you integrate that very cheaply? And then potentially without even having to ask industry for support. But what grew out of this concept was this concept to 3D print the systems, modify them quickly. So there's an RDT&E component, there's a prototyping component. And then very quickly, we built out the logistics footprint to print the systems anywhere in the world. And so that product is called XCell. And when you look at, you know, GovCon and folks that have the perfect product, they're going to die on that hill to make that product perfect. We had to make a pivot as a business to say, look, the drone space is fully saturated. It's a crowded market. How do you differentiate within a super crowded market? You can do that with price. Certainly, you can do that with capability. Usually, you don't get to do both of those. We took a different approach, and we said we would like to be able to produce these en masse anywhere and create manufacturing sovereignty for our partners and for the U.S. government. And so XCell was born. It is a containerized manufacturing cell that we can set up and start production in several hours. We're finding early adoption in the Air Force. They were the first to understand this agile combat employment model of distributed networks that could produce parts, repair parts, pieces, and also lethal systems at the edge. And very quickly, we found ourselves supporting the Army, specifically in parts repair for vehicles, weapon systems, et cetera. And so the pivot for our company came from going to UAS development and as a UAS company pure, and then transitioning to a myriad of other service support options, which aren't as sexy as flying systems that go boom, but certainly probably the most important aspect within a very crowded market. And so this also allows us to partner with other companies to produce parts repair for them, for their UAS systems, to work with integrators, to do payload, not only research and development with them, everybody needs a test platform, but also to integrate their systems to make sure their go-to-market is effective as well. During the questions that Catherine provided me a couple weeks ago, there were some great questions centered around, you know, some of the early contracts, some of the traction we've received. Our pipeline as a small company, as a four-year, you know, startup, is pretty massive right now. We're really proud of the, you know, kind of the progress we've made with the government customers as well as internationally. But it comes with a lot of risk, right? When you take on that much work, it really comes down to execution and what you can deliver on time. And so we are in the transitory period of the small company turning into a larger company, not a large company. And I would kind of equate it to the awkward teenage years of a business where HR becomes very important, hiring is essential, talent retention becomes more difficult and also way more important. And then also, how much money do you raise? And do you try to keep up with the other companies that are raising these, you know, crazy rounds with massive valuations? You know, where is the sweet spot for a company like ours? And so a lot of discovery learning, a lot of, you know, potentially preventable mistakes that we've learned over the past few years. But we're in a great spot as a company, looking at expanding our footprints out to the East Coast through some appropriations that we've been successful with, not only in the East Coast and Rome, New York, with AFRL Information Directorate, but also recently with Huntsville and Redstone Arsenal. And then we just delivered our first XL down to AFSOC at Herbert Field, Florida, which will be a manufacturing cell to support their RDT&E for their robotics programs. And so there's a million things we could talk about, but I think the essence of this is veterans and GovCon and looking at some of the challenges that come along with GovCon. I would say as a primer to kind of the Q&A is that the cycle for GovCon is really long. It's really frustrating, and you just don't know what world events are going to lead to. As we see right now, the CENTCOM has become the priority overnight. All the work that you do into IndoPACOM has to be able to pivot quickly. And so it's a bit schizophrenic at times working in the GovCon space. But I think the mission is you know, probably one of the most rewarding post-service that I could ever be a part of. And I'm proud to provide solutions to my former teammates and the folks that are still carrying the mail for the DOW.